Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The U.S. Department of Education, alarmed about the recent spate of suicides in young people, is sending a message to schools and colleges today. Make sure you're doing your part, as required by federal law, to protect kids. The reminder comes in the form of a 10-page letter. It was written after a year-long review of harassment, but acquired a new urgency after the recent suicides. Mary Bruce is with the ABC News. And Mary, the letter's being called a guidance letter. Tell us more about what it says.
It comes as a Dear Colleague letter that's being sent to schools across the country, and it's basically warning administrators that some student misconduct may fall under these federal anti-discrimination laws that are enforced by the Education Department's Office of Civil Rights. And it's basically saying that some schools may be failing to consider whether student misconduct, whether bullying and harassment may actually result in discriminatory harassment, that it falls under these different laws.
Well, and we're a little confused about the laws, so help us out. You write that current laws don't protect against harassment based on sexual orientation. They do protect people from gender stereotypes. What's the difference?
Yes, it is a very thin line and one that's kind of hard to wrap your head around. What they're saying is that when it comes to anything around gender stereotyping or being bullied for not conforming to a traditional gender role, that could rise to a level of violating Title IX, which prohibits any discrimination on the basis of sex, if that makes any sense.
To clarify further, so if a kid is just pointing a finger at another kid and saying, you're gay.
So if you point to someone and you say, you're gay, that actually is not breaking any of the rules. If you take that further and you make it a slur based on someone's gender, if you say you're a gay sissy, for instance, or if you take it any step beyond that, that then is breaking the law.
Because that's a stereotype.
Yes, because you are stereotyping someone's gender.
Well, and the letter is trying to straighten some of this out, but also remind schools of their responsibility. Now, Bloomberg News is reporting that schools that fail to take measures could face financial penalties.
Yeah, so here's how the ramifications work, basically. I mean, the initial step, obviously, the department would try and partner with the local school and sort of craft their own response, figure out what may be the best solution for this particular school. But if it goes further, it could lead to litigation. And even further, it could lead to the federal government withholding federal funding from a school. Now, that has actually never happened. The department, I'm told, has never actually withheld federal funding. But it is an option that's on the table and available to them.
Well, and we're reading Kristen Amundson. She's with an education think tank. She also served as chair to the Fairfax County School Board in Virginia. She's saying this move by the U.S. Department of Education is unprecedented. Is it?
It's unprecedented in the sense that, from my understanding, they have never extended the protection against harassment of gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgendered individuals based on gender stereotypes.
Well, an education department official says they're doing this in response to what they sensed was a growing problem with schools, and that the department's civil rights office received more than 800 harassment complaints over the last year. Is there a sense that there's some increase, you know, maybe not in the activity, but in the reporting of it?
Absolutely. I think the renewed push is certainly a response to this recent wave of suicides by gay teens, many of whom, you know, reported being bullied relentlessly. And the White House is really pushing back against the idea that bullying is some sort of adolescent rite of passage. They're saying that's absolutely not the case and that, you know, they have been taking efforts to counter this, and now they're sort of taking that a step further.
And does this apply to all schools, whether public or private?
Yes, this is something that every school across the country is getting.
And how is it likely to be received? We're imagining that there are schools, of course, already concerned with addressing this issue, but will there be schools that will accuse the administration of overreaching?
I think the response sort of remains to be seen. Most schools do have anti-bullying policies, but it is a reminder to a lot of them, and several schools may not know across the country that there are these federal anti-discrimination laws and that the Education Department does intend to enforce them.
And as you said, they're tied to funding. But one last question. What's your sense of what message this may be sending to parents and students? Is the federal government also saying, you know, schools may be responsible for this? You mentioned litigation from the federal government. What about litigation from parents and students?
Mm-hmm. I think it's sending a message to the schools and to parents and teachers and the students that the government is paying attention and that they do plan to take this extremely seriously and that there are options. that if a student or a parent doesn't feel that the school is taking it seriously enough, there are actions that they can take, and they can bring it to the federal government's attention.
Mary Bruce of ABC News on the 10-page letter being sent today from the U.S. Department of Education to thousands of schools and colleges across the country, warning them of their responsibility in enforcing federal laws when it comes to bullying and harassment. Mary, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Wow, there was wild weather today from the Dakotas to the eastern Great Lakes. Illinois may have seen the most powerful storm in over 7 decades. Flights were grounded at O'Hare Airport. That may have been a tornado outside of Chicago. People on Twitter are calling the storm Chiclone and Windpocalypse. And it reminds us, if disaster hits your neighborhood, are you prepared? The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention recently reported that disaster response is improving. President Obama told journalist Bob Woodward the U.S. can absorb another terrorist attack. But in his book, Woodward describes a top-secret desktop drill held earlier this year, a mock-up of a crude nuclear device attack on Indianapolis. The drill found the government woefully unprepared. So today we want to take a look at the state of disaster preparedness with Dr. Erwin Redlener, head of the National Center for Disaster Preparedness at Columbia University. So, Dr. Redlener, are we prepared?
Unfortunately, we are not prepared at a level that I think we should actually expect, given the fact that we're 9 years after the attacks of 9/11. That is not to say that we haven't made improvements, because we have. It's just that progress has been very slow, it's been very sporadic, and the net consequence of whatever we've been doing have not yet reached the standard where myself or others in this field can say that we're actually comfortable with where we are.
Well, the CDC says state labs and emergency centers are up to snuff, but it found many health departments not prepared for outbreaks and other emergencies that may occur. And we're reading that local health departments, you know, are cutting their workforces.
There is no entity that I'm aware of in terms of state or local health departments that are where they should be. The problem is that if there's a checklist and you ask the state health department, do you have lab capacities, for example, to diagnose particular kinds of biological agents, and they say yes, but we don't go deeper in terms of, well, how many samples can you analyze? How quickly can it be done? So I think we are on a collision course with cutbacks in state budgets, and that has actually weakened and will be continuing to weaken our capacity to respond. I don't want to make people feel depressed or anxious about this. On the other hand, I don't think it's appropriate for government to say that we are prepared, really, because we're not.
Well, and we actually have gotten to see that. You say there's a lot of confusion about the role of state versus federal versus local
right.
when it comes to response, and we watched that unfold during Hurricane Katrina and again with the BP blowout in the Gulf.
Correct. And I think one of the problems is that we don't seem to learn very well from our previous experiences. You know, one of the things that was so lethal on 9/11 was that problem of so-called interoperability of the radios, because the police and fire responders could not communicate with one another, and we lost probably 150 firefighters because of that. And that's a technical issue which we would have expected to be solved, but we have the technology, but the systems aren't yet implemented, really, as far as I know, in any major metropolitan area in the United States at this point. Let me maybe say that we have made very specific improvements in information that the public health workforce has. The CDC has been spectacularly effective in upgrading the level of information that federal public officials and really state public officials have in terms of information and procedures and so forth. What we're missing is enough funding to make sure that the resources are actually there to respond to a major event. And that's really one of the big challenges, especially in these economic conditions that we're living in.
Well, and some of the other challenges are, as you say, you know, what did we learn specifically from 9/11? You say that if there were another type of that kind of attack, knock on wood, you know, there'd still be a lot of confusion about, for instance, whether to have rescue workers rush right in.
Absolutely. Hopefully we'd have a lot more information and a lot more coordination and organization. But I don't feel confident that we're in a position yet that that would be necessarily the case.
Well, you're also very concerned about the readiness of hospitals, if there's, you know, even a pandemic. But we thought that people were really working on this, you know, after SARS and after some of the different scares.
Well, the situation with respect to hospital and health system readiness is something that's particularly vexing because we know what needs to be done. And actually, 5 years ago, the government put out very detailed guidance about what should be done in the states and localities to make sure that the health system was ready. The problem is that was, you know, I've referred to that as the mother of all unfunded mandates because there was no money behind it. Several studies have indicated that we need to make an initial investment of $5 billion in the nation's hospital systems to have them get up to a state of readiness that would be appropriate, and then at least $1 billion a year to maintain that. Well, we're now funding roughly $400 million a year for hospital readiness. There's not enough ventilators. There's not enough excess beds. We don't really know where we put people in a major pandemic.
Right. And, of course, as you know, we have to keep saying that all these good intentions about what should be done ran smack into the recession.
Yes, the acute problem is the recession, but one of the intractable problems is that our system is set up in a way that is not conducive to national disaster planning. What I mean by that is that the federal government can recommend, or they might put conditions on a grant, but the fact of the matter is that every state and almost every major locality has the right to determine exactly what it's going to do or not going to do. So if a grant is given to New York or Massachusetts or Nevada for preparedness, the states can determine how they will use that money. So it's like our federalist system of government, which in most instances has been great for the country. In the instance of trying to have national preparedness planning that's effective, the federalist system is actually a barrier to getting done what needs to get done.
So you're saying that there should be more of a top-down approach to this?
I think effective preparedness planning in the country requires simultaneous top-down and bottom-up. So, you know, there are particular areas where the risk, for example, of an earthquake is much higher than in other areas, or coastal storms, or terrorism, for that matter. And there has to be flexibility. But the general roadmap for what the country needs has to come top-down. Let's just take the issue of nuclear terrorism. You know, there's lots of loose nuclear material around the world. I'm not talking about dirty bombs with radioactively contaminated conventional explosive, but if we're talking about the actual detonation of a so-called crude nuclear device, like a small atomic bomb, which is not out of reach for a terrorist organization to acquire, you know, there are five or six major targets in the country that the federal government thinks could be targeted, and they're the cities that you might suspect, like Washington or New York. There should be no local option to not do preparedness for that kind of terrorism. Yet there isn't a single city in the United States that's done sufficient planning for this, nor do any of them have the intention or the resources to do so. So this is what I mean. I think there should be a fair amount of local flexibility, but there needs to also be adherence to what the federal government says. These are the risks, and this is what needs to be done about it.
Dr. Erwin Redlener, he heads the National Center for Disaster Preparedness at Columbia University, and we know this can be pretty depressing, but it's important information. And when we come back, listen up if you live near a nuclear plant. He has some information. And for everyone, what's in your go pack? And when did you last check it? Dr. Redlener's was filled with mice. Back in 1 minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide. On the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. We're checking in on the state of disaster preparedness with Dr. Erwin Redlener, who heads the National Center for Disaster Preparedness at Columbia University. And Dr. Redlener, you say average citizens play an enormous role in disaster preparedness, but that we as a country have to be more resilient the way the Israelis are. What do you mean?
Study after study has shown that people are just not doing the basics in terms of getting ready for disasters. And there's this sort of idea that whatever happens, that the responders will be there. I'll call 911 and somebody will come and help me. And that is, unfortunately, a very false premise, because the fact of the matter is that in terms of very large-scale disasters, the 911 response is going to be very limited and extremely slow, maybe days, in some cases never, before somebody actually shows up. So the basics about having a go-pack, of having a family plan to know where your kids would be and how to get everyone reunited, having a certain amount of food and water stored, battery-operated radios or hand-cranked radios. These things, which are considered, you know, like a pain in the neck, people are busy, they're worried about the economy, it seems like a burden, but if we needed it, it would be critical.
Well, it's on the Red Cross website, it's on FEMA's website. We
exactly.
all pretty much can, you know, as you said, a go pack if you have to grab it and run, or
yeah.
3 days of food and water per person if you're going to stay, clothing, tools, your eyeglasses, diapers.
Prescriptions,
any
yeah.
kind of records, you know, in a waterproof container. I had cash and tuna. And, you know, what ended up happening is I kept eating the tuna and taking the cash and using it. We have a producer here, her plastic water container in her kit, you know, 9 years later got brittle and leaked.
Yeah.
So is that a metaphor for, you know, people kind of, the more we get away from 9/11, the less they think about it?
But, you know, the problem, Robin, is that we had 9/11, we had Katrina, we had the oil spill. It's not like we're not getting disasters. It's just that these things, we keep calling them wake-up calls.
And then we go back to sleep.
Yeah, it's like they're more like snooze alarms. We're just kind of like, we hit the button, and then we sort of drift back into complacency. That's a problem. If we had some open discussions about how much we want to invest in preparedness as a country and as families, and decided this is what we can afford, this is what we're going to do, that's one thing. But the decisions that we're making about making the country secure and resilient seem random, generally inadequate, and don't build on our past experiences. And that's a problem, and it's a problem of leadership at every level of government.
Well, in addition to, you know, maybe pushing even just local legislators to get on the stick and maybe have a drill or let everyone know where their evacuation routes are or send out another flyer about what you should have, what else can people do? Just, you know, pack the disaster kit, check it. I understand you found that mice had eaten your almonds
yeah,
or something.
Exactly. So this is not a static situation. You have to keep checking. You have to review the family reunion plan if there's a major disaster or a blackout or whatever it might be. This is an ongoing process. There's another big issue, which is something called situational awareness. Keep your eyes open. Just be aware of what's going on in your environment. Doesn't mean you have to stop having fun or stop going to the mall or going to the movies and whatever you're doing with your family. Just means to be more aware of the fact that something may be going on that you need to be able to react to.
Are you one who would recommend that people who live near nuclear power plants have potassium iodide pills? They're supposed to
yeah.
protect the thyroid
yes.
gland.
Let me be clear about this. Nuclear power plant major accidents in general have been inadequately planned for. This is across the country, and I know there's been some recent reports that say everything's fine. It's not. In fact, the whole situation reminds me a lot of Deepwater Horizon and deepwater oil drilling in general prior to this accident,
okay.
where everyone was saying everything's fine, accidents don't happen, and we're prepared if they do. That's what you hear from the nuclear power industry, and I am deeply concerned about that. There's tremendous inadequacies in the response planning in virtually every community, and as far as potassium iodide is concerned, potassium iodide is specifically important for children and pregnant women who may be exposed to some of the radioactive materials that would come from a meltdown of a nuclear power plant. Potassium iodide has to be taken within a few hours.
So have it in your glove compartment in your car and at home.
Schools yeah. should have it. I think it should be available in local pharmacies. I think it should be in medicine cabinets. It's not a treatment for radiation sickness. It doesn't have anything to do with what would happen in a nuclear bomb explosion. It is specifically around the products that would come from a meltdown in a nuclear power plant, and it's specifically for children and pregnant women. A couple of years ago, and I'm part of this, the government set up something called the National Commission on Children and Disasters because kids make up actually 25% of the U.S. population, and they require very specific procedures and processes to protect them in the event of a disaster. And they have been, until really recently, until the commission's really been pushing government, they have been left out of the planning entirely. We just issued a report out of my center that 5 years after Katrina, we still have probably 20 to 30,000 children living in uncertain and unacceptable conditions in the Gulf states. I am very concerned that we haven't spent enough time focusing on disaster recovery. The president was supposed to release a report in June setting up a national recovery framework. Hasn't happened yet, and I really hope we can get on with that task very soon.
Dr. Erwin Redlener, director of the National Center for Disaster Preparedness, also professor of clinical population and family health at the Mailman School of Public Health at Columbia in New York. Dr. Redlener, thank you.
You're very welcome.
Well, We need a laugh right now, don't you think? Even if at public radio expense. Just about everyone has weighed in on NPR's decision to fire news analyst Juan Williams. And last night, The Daily Show's Jon Stewart jumped in.
That's it? That's what got him fired?
Yes, it was a direct violation of NPR's never say anything interesting policy.
Right.
They take great pride in that.
Ha ha ha. And as he introduced a montage of clips from Fox, Stewart pointed out that while NPR News shies away from opinions, Fox, well, doesn't.
NPR? You just brought a tote bag full of David Sedaris books to a knife fight.
Carl Rowe, Megyn Kelly, and Glenn Beck will all weigh in on this atrocious action.
Talking Points is calling for an immediate suspension of all public money going to NPR.
And this is another incentive for people to vote Republican.
The question this morning is, Waleed, is NPR an agent somehow of a jihadist inquisition?
That's Fox, man! Fox! They follow the Powell Doctrine of overwhelming force, shock, and claw.
To be continued, I'm sure. All right, we're going to take a break, after which a visit inside immigrant kitchens. I know, so public radio. Latest news is next, here and now. Baseball's World Series begins tomorrow night, and one thing is certain, one of the game's longest championship droughts will come to an end. The San Francisco Giants haven't won the World Series since 1954, when they were still in New York. The Texas Rangers have never won it all since they started playing ball in the Lone Star State in 1972. So let's preview this fall classic with Ted Keith, baseball editor for Sports Illustrated. And Ted, when we spoke earlier this month, when playoffs got underway, were you thinking we'd be talking a Giant-Rangers series now?
No, not at all. And I don't think a lot of other people were either. This is probably one of the most unexpected postseason matchups. We knew the Giants had great pitching going into this postseason. We didn't realize how good the Rangers' pitching was, but they've pitched the best in each of their respective leagues in the postseason. That's why they've gotten to the World
right.
Series.
Well, and you said pitching was going to be key. So going forward, who do you think has the edge when it comes to pitching?
I think the Giants have a deeper starting rotation and probably a more balanced bullpen than the Rangers do. The Rangers have a very good ace in Cliff Lee, who's maybe the single best postseason pitcher, not only this year, but in recent memory. But it's those number two and number three starters, C.J. Wilson, Colby Lewis, and even number four, Tommy Hunter, who don't match up quite as well, I think, with the Giants.
Well, so how about hitting? Who has the edge in hitting?
I think the Rangers definitely have a deeper offense than the Giants. The Giants have been struggling to score more than 3 runs a game for about 2 months now. Man, the Rangers don't have that kind of problem. The Rangers scored 38 runs in the American League Championship Series against the Yankees. They absolutely bludgeoned Yankee pitching from the top of the order to the bottom. Josh Hamilton was a series MVP with 4 home runs. There's really no easy outs anywhere in that lineup. We even saw Benji Molina hitting at the bottom of the order for Texas come up with some huge hits, including a home run against the Yankees. So it's the Rangers lineup is much better, but as we know, pitching can neutralize some of that hitting, and it's going to depend a lot, I think, on matchups late in the game. That's where the Giants' bullpen will come in handy.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, I was taking notes there. I'm not quite sure which column comes out longer. What do you think? I mean, who do you think has the overall edge?
I would say the Giants, probably, just because pitching is going to dominate the series so completely. You know, and the Rangers can pitch Cliff Lee at least twice in the series. We know how good he is, but he's going to be matched up at least in Game 1 and probably in Game 5 if it gets that far, too, with Tim Lincecum. And that's, in a way, that's someone who can neutralize the Rangers' offense the same way that Lee can completely shut down the Giants' offense. So there's really little margin for error for the Rangers, even when they have their best pitcher on the mound. In those other games, I just think the Giants have a pitching edge. But as we saw against the Phillies, we all thought the Phillies had the pitching edge in every game, and they're sitting at home going to watch this World Series like the rest of us.
Well, you know, you say that. Watch this World Series like the rest of us. I'll be watching, but do you think the bulk of fans will be, given that, you know, we know TV executives wanted it to be a New York-Philadelphia rematch, but that, you know, in my view, that cuts off about, seven-eighths of the country. Do you think people will flock to see Texas and San Francisco?
I would not expect the ratings to be as good as they were last year when you did have New York and Philadelphia. You had a tremendously compelling matchup in that regard. This time, it's a question of, do the general fans interested in watching Cliff Lee against Tim Lincecum as Giants fans and Rangers fans are interested in watching that matchup? My guess is the ratings will be down a little bit, but I think they'll still be fine because for real baseball fans, this is going to be a tremendous World Series.
Well, and does either team have that other compelling thing that gets people to tune in? Like, you know, the San Francisco Giants now have that kind of long-haired wackiness. Is there something like that that will compel people?
It's possible. I mean, the Giants have, you know, Kung Fu Panda, their third baseman, Pablo Sandoval, so fans dress up as Kung Fu Panda. Tim Lincecum has the long hair, so fans wear wigs to the ballpark. Buster Posey has become sort of a matinee idol out there. So there is a little bit of that, but I'm not sure the rest of the country is as aware of it as they might be now. One player who could drive casual fans to want to watch, though, I think, is Josh Hamilton. His story of recovery from addiction is fairly well known. He really introduced himself to the world a couple of years ago at Yankee Stadium during the Home Run Derby. And if people are aware that he's likely to be the AL MVP this year, if they're aware that he won the ALCS MVP against the Yankees, I think there might be a few more casual fans say, I want to see how this guy does.
Well, we noted that when they celebrated and shook those bottles, it was ginger ale.
That's right. Yeah, their Ranger teammates, they're an incredibly close team. I mean, the Giants, I think, are close as well, but almost in a different sort of fraternity house kind of way, whereas I think the Rangers are almost a Bible study type group.
Yeah.
It's the same in some ways what the Giants have, but also I think different enough that it paints these two teams in different ways.
Ted Keith, baseball editor for Sports Illustrated. Ted, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Okay, just ahead, the battle for state houses. The party in charge in every state is going to get to redesign congressional districts. That's in 30 seconds, here and now. One of the most watched governor's races in the country remains tight today. A new Quinnipiac University poll on the Ohio governor's race shows incumbent Democrat Ted Strickland, who's been campaigning in a camouflage-colored motorhome with the words endorsed by the NRA on the side, trailing but just by 6 points behind Republican former congressman and Wall Street banker John Kasich. As we mentioned yesterday, governor's races are being closely watched this year because whoever wins the corner office in key state houses may help shape elections across the country for years to come. How? Well, the party with the most power in every state gets to redraw legislative districts based on the 2010 census. The Democrats had that big, powerful role back in 2000. Many states this time around will lose or add congressional seats. Joining us from Columbus, Ohio is Peter Brown, assistant director of the Quinnipiac University Polling Institute. And Peter, just flesh this out. So you're saying voting next week is not just about who controls Congress next year, but how many years into the future?
Voting next week is about who controls Congress in 2012, and then who gets to draw the map to decide who's in Congress in 2014, 2016, 2018, and 2020.
Oh.
So there are some serious stakes. Also, frankly, is the fact that the reapportionment that's dictated by the census also changes the Electoral College.
So you've got a couple presidential elections that it will affect.
Yes.
Well, and you and others agree there's a good chance Republicans will have an edge in this redistricting. And you say it's all sort of a chess game or like an etch-a-sketch. Now, remind us how it works. The governor doesn't do this alone.
No, but in most states, the majority party in each house of the legislature and the party that holds the governorship gets to draw the map. Now, if one party holds all three offices, then they can draw a map to their heart's content. There are some guidelines they must follow, and courts can intervene but rarely do, so that the ability to draw a redistricting map is really a very powerful tool in putting together a political party.
Well, and so as you say, it's not just the governor's races, but it's, you know, state races that are all important because, as you say, if a party controls the legislature and the governor's office, well, then they've just got it made in the shade. And we're reminded what a stink this can provoke. In 2003, Texas Democratic state legislators fled that state into Oklahoma because they were so angry at the redistricting that was going on in Texas, and they didn't have the votes to stop it.
Right. Politics is about power, and redistricting is about power. And what makes it more important is that, again, there are a number of states that are going to lose congressional seats and a number of states that are going to gain congressional seats. And when that happens, it really can lead to some very creative map making.
All right. Well, let's take a look at Texas today. You've got Republican Governor Rick Perry leading former Houston mayor, the Democrat Bill White. This isn't a surprise to a lot of people. Texas is a traditionally Republican state. It is a tighter race than people thought, but the Republican Rick Perry is ahead. And you say Texas is the biggest prize and a mapmaker's dream if Republicans too get the state. Why? Remind us.
Well, Texas is the big winner from reapportionment. They will pick up four congressional seats, which means that the people in charge who are drawing the map can draw it to their advantage, and not just the four-seat new seats that will be created. That allows them to reopen the entire map. The basic rule of redistricting politics is that you draw a map that puts as many of the other people's voters in a small number of districts to let them win those districts by a huge percentage, and therefore you drain away the opposition's voters.
And as a result, you've got these huge contortions sometimes on the maps. They look like starfish.
Word is gerrymandering.
Well, and you say courts do sometimes get involved.
But rarely.
Why don't they more?
Because the courts have generally ruled that it is not their business, unless there is a direct violation of a constitutional right.
Well, let's take a look at some of the other states. Florida. We spoke of Florida yesterday. The governor's race, a toss-up between Republican Rick Scott and Democrat Alex Sink. And Republicans already are in the control of the legislature in Florida. So what's at stake there? How many seats?
Well, Florida will pick up two more congressional seats because of the redistricting. And again, the governor's race is a very tight race. If Rick Scott wins the governorship, that'll give the Republicans unfettered access to the map-making pen.
But if Alex Sink wins, how often
then there's horse trading.
Well, I was going to say, what is the battle like between, a governor from one party and a legislature from another?
It's a much less partisan map because one side can refuse to approve the other side's map.
Right. Well, let's move to Ohio. That's where you are. A neck-and-neck governor's race. But the legislature is split there. So tell us what's, the thinking there.
Well, in Ohio, the Republicans have a 22-16 lead in the Senate. But they'd need to pick up a dozen House seats to have complete control of the legislature, and obviously they would need to win the governor's race. Here's a simple way to look at it. Ohio's going to lose two seats. If Kasich wins and the Republicans are able to take control of the House of Representatives, then it's a pretty good bet that the map will be drawn so that those two seats come out of primarily Democratic areas.
Right.
But if Mr. Strickland wins the governorship, or if Kasich wins the governorship and the Democrats hold the House, then it's likely that what would happen is that each party would take a hit of one seat.
Yeah. Well, and let's wrap up with New York, where Andrew Cuomo has a commanding lead against the Republican Carl Paladino. And you write, New York is the only state where Democrats are likely to find themselves in the driver's seat.
That's
on
right.
This issue. Yeah. What do you predict will happen there?
Well, in New York, again, Mr. Cuomo is the closest thing to a lock. Probably in a major state this year. I mean, he's up by over 20 points in the polls. And the Democrats already have the State House of Representatives, the State Assembly is what it's called in New York.
Mm-hmm.
The one Republican chance to stop the Democrats from having complete control in New York is that the Republicans need to pick up two state Senate seats. If they do that, then they would have control of the state Senate, and they would be able to force a more equitable redistribution of the seats. But otherwise, if the Democrats are able to keep the Senate and keep the House and the governorship, they can draw away.
And what they have to deal with in New York is the loss of two seats. And again, they will probably make sure that it's from Republican-leaning counties.
Correct.
Yeah. Well, and as we said, after the 2000 census, it was the Democrats that controlled more redistricting. They controlled about 143 seats to the Republicans' 68 seats. This time around, by some estimates, the Republicans will be controlling about the same number the Democrats did after 2000, 100 and something, while the Democrats may only have 60 something. So there may be some balance there. But still, is there any, move to change the system so that it doesn't swing like a pendulum?
No, there are some states where there are commissions that are more or less impartial, given the different state, where it's not done by the governor and the
right.
legislature, but that's unusual. There are an awful lot of people who are invested in the current system.
That's Peter Brown, Assistant Director of the Quinnipiac University Polling Institute, on the redistricting issues that are at stake in the midterm elections. Peter, thank you. Fascinating.
My pleasure. Have a good day.
Proust had his Madeleines. Chairman Mao is said to have loved braised pork belly. For Lynn Christie Anderson, it's lemon meringue pie.
My grandmother's lemon meringue pie is my Madeleine. And like Proust's narrator, whenever I'm offered a piece now, I find myself plunged into that long-ago place where several generations of us would gather for dinner, my grandmother at the head of the table. Her voice is a distant echo now, but it lingers nevertheless. She makes her apologies. She could have added another drop of lemon to the custard. The crust is slightly underdone this time. The meringue, too sweet. The rest of my family, my grandfather, parents, brother and sister, aunts, uncles and cousins are there too. Their younger selves call out from around the table in protest, telling her the pie is just as wonderful as ever.
Lynn Christie Anderson is a former chef and a teacher, also author of Breaking Bread, Recipes and Stories from Immigrant Kitchens, stories of how food brings home a little closer. And Lynn joins us in the studio with more. Welcome.
Thanks for having me, Robin.
Just flipping through, you've talked to people from the Dominican Republic. Our colleague Bruce Gellerman's wife is featured, Yulia Govorushko from Russia. Now, your grandmother that you speak of and the lemon meringue that she made, your grandmother wasn't an immigrant, but her mother was?
Yeah, her mother came from Cork in Ireland, and the stories of her, you know, immigrating and first coming here figure prominently in kind of some of the family tales that I heard up growing up. Yeah. So.
And so how did you make that feeling that you had? How did you connect with other immigrants and their stories?
Well, I first started teaching immigrant adults in the Boston Public Schools about 10 years ago. I had retired from being a chef. And I remember looking out into this classroom of faces, you know, mothers and fathers from places like Pakistan and India and China and El Salvador, and grandparents from Cape Verde and Brazil, and wondering, you know, how was I going to connect with them? I'm a new teacher. They were almost scared to be in the school. They were there for their kids who were Boston Public School students, hoping that they could at some point help them with homework, learn enough English to navigate the schools. And I just started talking to them about food. I love to cook and eat and talk about food, so I'd ask them what they had brought in to share with the class that day or what they had cooked over the weekend. And before I knew it, they were bringing in their foods for me to try. It was our common language, that was the way that we connected. You know, for people like my students, people who had come from very far away and left almost everything behind, that food was almost symbolic.
And a good way to learn English, as it turns
right.
out, you know.
Yep.
Well, let's talk about some of these people. One, a gentleman from a small village in Cote d'Ivoire. He now lives in Boston. His name is Dakpa Zaidi, and he makes a chicken stew. Now, we'll put all these recipes at our website, the ones we talk about. One of the things he reveals is that when he goes back to Cote d'Ivoire, people are surprised that he cooks.
Yeah. Zaidi's got a great story. He never cooked in Africa. He said that's really... That was his mother's job, and that is women's work, and it's really frowned upon for men to cook. So he says, I really can't even tell them back home that I'm cooking because they'd be worried about me. But he loves to cook, and in fact, he cooks for his girlfriend, and he's a very good cook, and that stew is wonderful.
Yeah. You also meet an engineer from China. She works at a supermarket in the Boston area, and you want to know more about her life in China, and your way to her is through food.
Right. I met her in Whole Foods Market where I've been shopping, and I think I was perusing the Asian vegetables and kind of struck up a conversation, and then we've just kind of become friendly over the years. And when I started to work on this book, I knew that she loved food, and she seemed like a really gifted cook. She always was telling me about these incredible things that she had made when I would see her. So, yeah, I was invited into her house, and she cooked seriously like 13 or 14 different dishes that day. It was just, you know, ingredients that I had never seen. I also shopped with her.
Like, what are some of the ingredients or the dishes, too?
Well, winter bamboo, which I'd never cooked. You know, for me, bamboo came out of a can. That's the way that, you know, my mother used to stir fry it when I was a kid. So she took me shopping at the time of year. I think it was February or early March when the winter bamboo was still available, and showed me how to prepare it.
How do you prepare winter bamboo?
You have to steam it and, first remove this very gnarly skin, which is a little bit of work, and then steam it and then stir fry it. And then she serves it with with soy sauce and then gingko nuts and mushrooms. Mm. It was an incredible combination of flavors and textures. It was really good.
Yeah. Well, and then there's Yasi Sadat, a young woman from Iran who lives in Newton, Massachusetts now with her parents. And she joins us in the studio. Yasi, welcome.
Hi, thank you.
And we understand you were in the seventh grade when you came to the U.S. And we have, oh my gosh, we have some of the dishes that you've prepared here, and the aroma in the studio is wonderful. What types of foods do this to you? What types of foods take you closer to your home, Iran?
Stews that we have, that it's made out of different combinations of herbs and vegetables, usually served with rice, or even a lot of different kinds of bread that nowadays it's easier to find than it was previously a few years back.
And you can use that bread to sop up one of these dishes here. This is my favorite dish at a local Iranian restaurant, Lala Roque, here in the Boston area, and now I'm going to be able to get the recipe for my favorite dish because you've got it right here. What is this?
This is called Keshke Bademjon. It's an eggplant dish that is famous for being made with this ingredient called kashk. It's a yogurt product. Some people refer to it as whey. And what really gives it the taste is the kashk.
Is that it? The thing that makes your cheeks pucker?
Yeah, it has a very distinct flavor.
Oh, it's delicious. Yeah. What else is in this dish? We're going to have, again, the recipe and pictures at our website. But what else? It's beautiful. As we look at it, it almost looks like you've drizzled different things, all the colors, the red and the brown of the eggplant, and then the white of the kash.
Yeah.
But what else is in it?
The base ingredient of it is the bademjon. Most of the Iranian dishes is the eggplant. Most of the Iranian dishes actually rely on the actual ingredient for the taste to come through. So you will taste the eggplant plus the kashk. But in addition, this is garnished with caramelized onions.
That's the sweetness, the caramelized onions.
Yes, it is. Mm-hmm. And then you follow it with some fried dried mint, and then some more of the kashk on top for garnish, as well as saffron, which is almost a must in every Iranian dish.
Well, that's Yassi Sadat, again from Iran. And by the way, is it sometimes, bittersweet even to make these dishes because you're here and not there? Mm-hmm. Because it maybe reminds you too much?
No, not really. It's mostly comfort food.
Comfort.
Yeah.
Comfort food. It's so, we're hearing Lynn Christie Anderson about comfort food for immigrant communities. You know, for some of us, comfort food is a tuna noodle casserole with potato chips on top. But is that what you found for these other people recently from other countries, that this was their comfort food?
Absolutely. For some of them, it's the only thing that they can really hold on to. Particularly the mothers that I interviewed who have kids that are now speaking English at home, so they're losing language. Some people from the book have lost socioeconomic status. You know, there's a lawyer from El Salvador who's now working as a janitor. Some of them are here alone, and the food is the one way to kind of connect to the past. But also, serve as a bridge into the future because, the people that are cooking for kids and grandkids, that's a way to instill the culture. That's a way to give them a taste of, back home.
Yeah.
This is the story of, immigration in America. People coming and making a new life here, for the most part, feeling very hopeful, feeling very thankful about being here, but also knowing that, something was lost along the way, that they did leave things at home.
Lynn Christie Anderson. Her book is Breaking Bread, Recipes and Stories from Immigrant Kitchens. We were also joined by Yassi Sadat, one of the people featured in the book. I want to thank you both for joining us. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
And can we have that eggplant dish?
Absolutely.